Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, our correspondent reports on the sentiment in Bangkok following two explosions. An analyst considers the new controversial anti-terrorism law in Egypt. A psychiatrist speaks with us about the practice of ghosting.
It's rude. Anyone who says this is a considerate way to handle an awkward situation has never been ghosted.
And a look at a new docudrama about the rise and fall of a music group that revolutionized hip-hop and rap, coming up here on The Voice of America. Thai police have released a video of the suspected bomber in Monday's deadly blast that killed over 20 people, most of them foreigners. Our correspondent has been on the streets of Bangkok collecting information on this story since it happened. And Steve Herman joins us on the line. Steve, what can you tell us about this video?
Well, the video does show an individual wearing a yellow shirt with this backpack and presumably dropping off an object inside the backpack and leaving it at this shrine at the exact spot where the bomb went off several minutes later. So to say that this guy is prime suspect number one at this point is probably an understatement, although the authorities are hedging a little bit, just saying that he's one of the suspects that they would definitely like to identify.
Now, we've had another bombing since then. We had one today.
Yes, this was some sort of explosive device. They're not calling it a grenade, but something like that. It was dropped off the King Toxin Bridge, and panicking people on the nearby river ferry pier who were waiting for boats to go across the Chao Phraya. And there is closed circuit television video of that explosion as well, and it showed the device detonating in the water, but fortunately there were no injuries.
You've been on the street speaking with people. What are people saying about all this?
Well, everyone is obviously very concerned, very mystified as to who would do this and why, because there are no clear answers. There's no claims of responsibility. And wondering if this is going to be a period of renewed violence. And this bombing last night at the Erawan Shrine is unprecedented. We've really never seen anything like this in Bangkok. Targeting tourists deliberately put into a place where the bombers had to know that there would be a large number of people, especially foreigners, and mostly from other Asian countries.
And Bangkok relies heavily on the tourism industry to keep afloat.
Absolutely, and there's been an immediate impact. The baht has gone down to a six-year low against the U.S. dollar. Investors widely sold Thai stocks today, the key index closing down more than 2.5%. And tour operators are confirming that they're already seeing cancellations by those apparently too frightened to travel here.
Is the government doing anything about that to encourage tourism?
Well, the head of the junta, the Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha, came on television this afternoon on all the channels and sought to reassure everybody that Thailand is still safe and that they're going to find the perpetrators and bring them to justice as soon as possible, and clearly indicating that this was a politically motivated bombing targeting the economy and tourism for whatever reason.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today, Steve.
You're welcome.
Matt Wheeler is the Bangkok-based representative of the International Crisis Group. We asked about the significance of bombing the Erawan Hindu Shrine in central Bangkok.
It evokes a number of things. One is the recent demonstrations over the last couple of years. The pro-Thaksin Shinawat red shirts rallied there in 2010, and of course were suppressed by the army in May that year in that vicinity. More recently, protesters opposing the government of Yingluck Shinawat also rallied there. And the Erawan Shrine is considered a very potent spiritual location in Bangkok. But perhaps more significant for this attack is the fact that that intersection represents a center in Bangkok, which is a rather spread-out, large city. But the Rajpasong intersection, where the Erawan Shrine is located, is something of a commercial hub, a shopping hub, and could be said to represent downtown Bangkok. Also, it's evident that a number of the casualties were Chinese nationals, and indeed the shrine has been popular with tourists from China and from Taiwan for many years. So that may be significant as well.
There's been a huge outpouring of sympathy and support for Thailand on social media. Michael Lippin is here in the studio to tell us more about that. Michael, how big is that support?
Well, hi, Susan. It is just enormous, especially on Twitter. The most widely used hashtag to show support for the Thai capital is hashtag Pray for Bangkok. The Topsy Analytics website says that's been used in at least 344,000 tweets in the last 24 hours. Another hashtag that is almost as popular is hashtag Stronger Together. That's been mentioned 134,000 times in the same period. And, you know, many of the people using those hashtags are Thais. And they're using the hashtag Stronger Together in particular to make a point. And that is that Thais should unite in the face of any attempt to divide them, if that was the intention of Monday's bomb attack. You can also see the slogan in a variety of images on Twitter. I saw one posted by a Thai Twitter user who put up a rather touching cartoon sketch of five people holding hands with Thai flags on their chests and the words Stronger Together at the top of the picture. A lot of people also have been sharing images in support of Thailand on Facebook. You can find them if you do a Facebook search for photos with a hashtag Pray for Bangkok. One image that caught my attention was posted by Facebook user Panipa Sintrakul. She works for a Thai employment agency in Bangkok, and she posted an image of herself with her hand held up in front of her face and the hashtag PrayForBKK visible on her wrist. That photo has received 3,200 likes in just over 12 hours.
That's a lot, Michael. Well, what are some of the other hashtags people are using?
Well, there are a few more, actually. One is hashtag Pray for Thailand. That's been used 82,000 times in the past day. Then there's hashtag Stay Strong Thailand, which has had about 9,000 mentions in the same time frame. And we also have hashtag We Love Thailand, which has been used 7,000 times. So there's a lot to choose from. Susan?
Thank you, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A group of scientists have discovered a new exoplanet they say resembles a young Jupiter. Called 51 Eridani b, the gas giant is about 100 light years away, has twice the mass of Jupiter, orbits its star at a distance comparable to between Saturn and Uranus in our solar system, and is a youthful 20 million years old. By comparison, the Earth, Sun, and most other objects in our solar system are about 4.5 billion years old. The light from the exoplanet is very faint to begin with, and with its host star glowing at about 3 million times brighter, it would have been very difficult to make the discovery without some special equipment. The scientists were able to pick up on the faint planet and overcome the blinding luminosity of its star by using a specially designed device called the Gemini Planet Imager, or GPI. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Egyptian President Abdel Oh, we're apparently having some technical problems, and while our technician and director figure out exactly what's happened, I have a little announcement for you. The Broadcasting Board of Governors, the U.S. government agency that supervises the Voice of America, has announced the appointment of a new chief executive officer. That is John Lansing, former president of Scripps Networks, which develops and distributes news and entertainment program over multiple media platforms. Lansing will take up his position next month, the BBG said in a statement. As chief executive, he will be responsible for supervising all U.S. government-funded civilian international news media. We now return to our program. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has approved a controversial new anti-terrorism law that gives security officials wider immunity from prosecution, metes out harsh penalties, including capital punishment for terror-related crimes, and imposes stiff fines on journalists who report so-called false news about terrorism. My colleague Victor Beatty is here with me right now and is following this story. Victor, what do you have?
Hello, Susan. Well, the new law has been denounced by rights groups as draconian. Amnesty International warned the law will vastly expand powers that would usually only be invoked during a state of emergency and effectively ban the rights to freedom of expression, peaceful assembly, and association. The law, announced Monday, was ratified by Mr. Assisi on Sunday and follows escalating attacks that have killed hundreds of security force personnel, including the country's top prosecutor last June. RAND Corporation regional analyst Ben Connable told me Egypt knows of no other way to stop militant attacks.
Well, I think in context, it is draconian. The problem is that Egypt doesn't have a long history of being able to deal with these problems successfully in any other way than using force or draconian legal measures. So I think that they're just following a pattern that's long established, and unfortunately they're unable to break out of it.
What's the status of the fight against terrorism in Egypt right now?
All open reports show that it's not going all that well. They're starting to lose control over parts of the Sinai Peninsula, which is problematic because not only for tourism but also for Egypt's security on its eastern border, it's going to be a serious problem over time. More importantly, though, the more territory they're unable to control, the more difficult it becomes to control Cairo and its environs, Alexandria, and then really there's a large swath of the desert down the Nile that historically has been very difficult to control. The Egyptians themselves call it bandit territory. I don't know the current situation in the uncontrolled areas in the center.
Why, with all the crackdown over the past couple of years since the ouster of President Mohamed Morsi, has Egypt been unable to get a handle on the fight against terrorism?
If you look at Egypt's history, it's really unsurprising. There's been, actually for about 5 or 6 decades, Egypt has been in a state of kind of meta-stability where they really have never solved any of the underlying inherent intrinsic problems in their society. There's widespread poverty, lack of education, inability of the government to provide services to the people in most areas. So the Egyptian government simply approaches things in a head-on manner.
What can U.S. policy do to moderate this law in any way? Does this put the U.S. in a precarious position with its support of the Cairo government?
It does, and I think the U.S. has been in that position with the Cairo government and with many governments around the region for quite some time. The U.S. doesn't want to allow Egypt to slide into chaos or to turn Egypt over to the Muslim Brotherhood. The brief experiment with the Muslim Brotherhood was unsuccessful. However, at the same time, the longer the U.S. continues to support a government that passes laws like this, especially problematic are the parts that affect journalists or might affect journalists, the more difficult it becomes for the U.S. to press for democracy and to win support from moderate elements within the Egyptian populace.
The New York Times reports the law shows how power is increasingly concentrated in the hands of the Egyptian leader, who has ruled the country by decree since July 2013, when he led the military ouster of Mr. Morsi, an ally of the now outlawed Muslim Brotherhood. The Times, citing the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy, says the new Egyptian leader has issued more than 175 new laws since his official inauguration last year, while Egypt has had no sitting parliament or any other meaningful check on his authority.
Thank you very much, Victor, for that report.
Thank you, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, ghosting. It's not what goes bump in the night. An insight into a music group that revolutionized hip-hop and rap. The practice of ghosting is becoming more prevalent in social and business situations. Some consider it rude, others a considerate way to avoid unpleasantness. On the line with us is psychiatrist Dr. Nzinga Harrison. Welcome, doctor, to our program.
Thank you.
Could you please explain to us just what is ghosting?
Sure. So ghosting is when someone completely disappears from a relationship with no notice at all. So it comes from kind of like Casper the Ghost. One minute you see him, one minute you don't. And when people leave a relationship, leaving the other person to wonder what in the heck happened, you try to call, you try to text, you try to email, and the other person is literally just dropped off the face of the earth. You've been ghosted.
Now, this can be a personal relationship, but it also sometimes happens in business.
It does, which is incredible to me because the old adage, you know, don't burn your bridges, pretty much flies out the window when you ghost a business relationship. But business relationships, especially when, you know, maybe there's contention over finances, can be as difficult to navigate conflict as personal relationships. And that's really the basis for ghosting, is the ultimate avoidance of conflict.
Is it rude or a considerate way to handle awkward situations?
It's rude. So anyone who says this is a considerate way to handle an awkward situation has never been ghosted. We are a society that really kind of emphasizes this aspect of closure and being able to know what happened and, you know, knowing the role that we played in relationships that ended. And when you ghost someone, whether for business or personal reasons, you really remove the ability for that person to know what happened and leave them in a state of limbo. So it's really a very, very passive, aggressive, hostile, mean thing to do.
Yeah.
In no way is it courteous.
Hurts your feelings. Well, why does this practice, why is it rising in our culture?
You know, I think there are a couple of reasons why it's rising. One that people commonly point to is technology, but from an angle maybe that people don't really consider. So like the Facebooks and the Twitters and the Instagrams, et cetera, I'm too old to know what all of them are these days, really allow us to be connected to more people that are not in our immediate geographic space. And so before, it would be difficult to ghost someone because you would probably run into them at the grocery store, or you would see them at work, or you would see them at church, or you would see them at the football game on Saturday. Now with all of these social media connections where we have relationships over longer distances that really require that we're proactive about seeing people face-to-face, you can ghost from an electronically based relationship and never have to worry about kind of the discomfort of running into that person unplanned.
I'm wondering if all this social media business is making us a little insensitive because we're not having eye-to-eye contact. We're not touching them, shaking hands. We're dealing with a machine, after all. And some people deal with the machine all the time and really don't have an interaction with another human or another animal.
I completely agree with you because when you're in a room, right, eye contact actually affects you physiologically, biologically. You get processes through your body, you know, your heart beats, your stomach responds. You can feel the way a person breathes. You're connected through pheromones. And all of that is lost over the technical relationship. All of those things serve to connect us even more and to make it even more difficult to be mean to a person, which is what ghosting is. Ghosting is just being mean. When you're over the computer, you don't have those same biological signals that drive you away from that aggressive act. And so it's much easier to just cut it off and go about your way.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us, Doctor. And it's an interesting phenomenon.
It is. It is.
This is VOA.
This is Greenbee for a healthier planet.
Waste not, want not. That could be the motto of a shopping center in Brazil that's growing vegetables for its employees on its rooftop by using the waste from the mall at the garden. Besides providing food for employees, the initiative aims to reduce the mall's carbon footprint by reducing the amount of trash that would end up in a garbage dump. About 400 kilos of organic waste are generated every day from the mall's eateries, explains Cicero Evangelista, who is in charge of recycling.
We weigh the material and add enzymes that eliminate bacteria, reduce humidity, and accelerate decomposition. This is how we turn organic waste into organic compost.
In an effort to save as much waste as possible, workshops are held for mall employees so they can learn how to best collect garbage from their stores. Now that's something to feel good about, a project that reuses, reduces, and has social benefits. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
There's a new hit movie in the United States, a docudrama about the rise and fall of NWA. Music group that revolutionized hip-hop and rap. The film, Straight Outta Compton, chronicles the discontent in Compton, a poor inner-city neighborhood of Los Angeles, wedged between gang violence and police abuse. It also looks at how hip-hop music expressed the black community's anger and other emotions. Here is a look at the film from VOA's Penelope Ballou.
Where you think you're going?
Man, I'm just trying to get home.
That's my son!
You need to get back in the house or I will ruin your night.
You ain't gotta talk to
me. In the tough black neighborhood of Compton, it often seemed like a teenager could not leave his house without getting into some kind of trouble with the police or gangsters.
You had the chance to change the situation. Would you take it?
Gary Gray's Straight Outta Compton docudrama shows how that volatile state of affairs became the seedbed of rap music in the 1980s.
Cruising down the street in my 6-4.
And so N.W.A., the first rap group, was born.
You're listening to Compton's very own Ice Cube, Eazy-E, and Dr. Dre. I gotta tell you, you are witnessing history.
The group's tough lyrics on drugs, violence, and poverty and its visceral music took the world by storm. Filmmaker Gary Gray says he worked hard to keep the story as authentic as possible, actually filming in Compton.
This is not only history, it's American history, it's world history. And so I get a chance to put on my journalist hat and be a historian.
People are scared of you guys. You have a unique voice. The world needs to hear it.
They want N.W.A.? Let's give them N.W.A.
We put it all in the music, all our frustration and anger.
Ice Cube, now a Hollywood mogul, remembers what it was like.
Our music was like our weapon.
And that's the most powerful weapon we got.
His son, O'Shea Jackson Jr., portrays his father as a young man.
They shed light on things that people needed to know.
Speak a little truth and people lose their minds.
But their lyrics prompted harsh public reaction outside of Compton.
Your songs, they glamorize gangs and drugs.
Our art is a reflection of our reality.
The film focuses on N.W.A.'s rise to fame and follows it through its rifts and final breakup.
Sit tight and let us do our job.
Hey, officer, I'm sorry. What is going
Sir,
on out?
Can you stay right there, please?
But its scenes of police violence are especially hard-hitting after the recent deaths of unarmed black men such as Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York City at the hands of police.
Well, you're wasting your time, Mr. Manager.
You gotta be kidding me.
You're wasting your time.
Really?
These clients of yours, these rappers, they look like gang members.
You can't come down here and arrest people just because of what they look like. Are you crazy? But that's police harassment.
Straight Outta Compton has attracted positive reviews for offering an authentic portrayal of N.W.A. and for taking us back to a time when daily violence bred a different kind of music. Penelope Hulu, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks for joining us for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is gravely concerned about the plight of the Rohingya population in Southeast Asia. The Rohingya are a Muslim minority population of around 1.2 million people living in Burma's Rakhine State, where they are subject to religious-based discrimination and violence and exploitative conditions, including forced labor by the Burma Army, undue restrictions on freedom of movement, and impeded access to medical care and food. They are restricted in marriage and building or maintaining religious buildings. Despite living in Burma for generations, they are made stateless by policies set by previous military regimes. Tens of thousands live in camps for internally displaced persons, with little access to livelihoods, markets, food, or places of worship. They have become increasingly vulnerable to human traffickers, who entice them with promises of a better life abroad. Up to an estimated 500,000 undocumented Rohingya refugees live in neighboring Cox's Bazar district in Bangladesh, and around 32,000 registered Rohingya live in the district's Kutupalong and Nayapata refugee camps, having fled military campaigns and sustained persecution in Rakhine State. The United States has consistently called on the Burmese government to improve the humanitarian situation in Rakhine State by allowing unrestricted humanitarian access to all communities in need and facilitating the voluntary return of all internally displaced Rohingya to their places of origin. President Obama voiced his concerns earlier this summer.
I think if I were Rohingya, I would want to stay where I was born. I'd want to stay in the land where my parents had lived. But I'd want to make sure that my government was protecting me and that people were treating me fairly. That's what I'd want. And that's why it's so important, I think, as part of the democratic transition, to take very seriously this issue. of how the Rohingya are treated.
We must all work together to address the conditions in Rakhine State.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.